for a bit of celebration on the part of the committee. We had lunch and numerous cocktails at nearby Trader Vic's. I should go back and state that immediately after the annual meeting of the membership in February 1963, it seemed desirable that the old planning committee be reorganized. What happened was we amalgamated planning committee and the beach development committee into one and called it the building committee. Two members of the former planning committee dropped off. That was Hal Whitaker and Dickie Thacker, leaving as the building committee myself, Ward Russell, Tom Wells, Keith Wallace, General Schmuck, Walter Collins. Can you stop a second? The board of directors authorized the officers to execute a contract with Pacific Construction, the construction to start on or about April 1st, 1963. And the news, the membership committee of the club, in conjunction with the board of directors, decided that that would be a fine time to have a party for the membership. Accordingly, a party was planned at the new site on a given Saturday, given Sunday. People could come in and park in the on the site, the clear site, under a tent, drink beer, see the surf, see the canoes, and all about the new site, so they'd have a good idea of what was in store for them in the next 8 or 9 months. And the very next day, April 1st, as I recall, the contractor moved in and commenced constructing the new club. The good Lord favored us over the next ensuing 9 months with almost perfect weather. Only one day in the next 9 months did it rain hard enough so that the contractor had to suspend operations. At one time we were threatened with a loss of one day in pouring of concrete because HC&D was having a strike which was going to be 1, 2, 3 days, no one seemed to know. But on an hour's notice, we told the contractor in no uncertain terms that we were not going to sit by and let one day go by, that he had to seek concrete from another supplier so that he wouldn't miss that particular pour, which happened to be about the fourth level of parking. And he succeeded in getting Pacific Concrete to supply them for that particular day, and they didn't lose a single hour. We were very lucky. One of the big things that we wanted was, for many reasons, mainly psychological, but we wanted the membership to come down to the club and be faced with a club that looked like it had been here for many years. We didn't want it to look like a brand new club, which meant that the trees that came in were not could not be of the young variety. For example, we would not bring in coconuts like we did, or my dad did, down at the old new site, where the conventional way of planting a coconut was to put the coconut in the ground with about 2 or 3 feet sprouting above and let nature take its course over the next 25 years. We decided that the coconuts that would be brought in, and eventually we were to plant 80 of them, would all have to be at least 25 years or older. These we got very cheaply because normally people try to get rid of coconuts. The major cost in planting tall coconuts is, of course, the labor and machinery cost, namely the flatbed and the crane. The labor cost also. We were able to get all of our coconuts at $100 a piece, and I understand that $300 or $400 is the going rate nowadays. But I'm getting ahead of my story. Mrs. Robert Thompson, otherwise known as Kitty, we had engaged as our consultant in landscaping. And we had a budget of about $22,000, which couldn't take you very far in 1982, but in 1963 we got a lot for our money. I mentioned the 80 coconut trees. She was the one that laid out the original plan. We wanted the coconuts placed in such a way that it would look like we had planted a new building amongst an existing coconut grove. We also had to preserve the old hoe terrace concept. This wasn't easy. We had to transplant hoes in their slip form. When I say slip, I mean cutting form, although they were mature. The first 9 hoes that we brought in were about 12 feet tall, about 6 or 8 inches in caliper, and they came directly from Tantalus, which is just about a quarter mile down the Brown Top Road from Roy Bush's house. These eventually went in just as hibiscus. How is nothing more than a hibiscus. It's a member of the hibiscus family. And we stuck them in the ground and hoped for the best. And I guess I took the brunt of it, because it was promptly and immediately labeled Kleinman's Folly. Well, I might be getting ahead of the story, but those particular hoes came in December and showed no growth at all until April or May of 1964, at which time leaves did appear on at least 6 of them, and 3 had to be eliminated. Eventually, 2 more had to be eliminated and replaced by hoe trees that we had already anticipated using by having them growing in the Kiki Nursery. And these were brought in at about 2-inch caliper and have subsequently developed into big trees. And of course, the roof over the hoe terrace is virtually forest.
Representing 9 years of growth and a little bit less for some of the ones that you had to replace.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the other features of trying to meet this particular deadline was that it wasn't until September that we got around to selecting furniture and furnishings. And here again, we followed our previous formula of going with quality, and we're very impressed with the John McGuire furniture. As expensive as it was, but it seemed to be of the quality we wanted and within our budget, and we thought that we could get it in time. Here again, we're very lucky. The John McGuire furniture, which is all of the chairs in the dining room and the bar, are, I forget what you call this stuff.
Rattan.
Rattan with leather thongs. They all had to come from California. Excuse me, they all had to come from the Orient. The McGuire...
The metal with the plastic.
Yeah, all of the rattan stuff had to come from the Orient. This is all stuff they just bring in. What I'm saying is that the cloth block, the pillows and the the paddings and all had to come from San Francisco. And how we maintain our luck, I'll never know. But the two freighters carrying the two loads arrived in Honolulu a day apart. And we decided that rather than have our contractor, Western Interiors, take all of the stuff from the pier to his warehouse for assembly, we decided to have him come out to the Otwe Canoe Club, and the dining room was sufficiently complete in December for use as a night warehouse, a daytime warehouse. So all of the assembly took place out here.
Shortcut.
Yeah, and we must have saved several days there. But we needed every day in order to get to that very important Christmas party.
All right, now we're all furnished, and we've got big trees in, and is it just about Christmas time? Are we ready for the party?
Yes, we've gotten all of our landscaping in also, and it's substantial. We invested in quite a bit of a number of trees on the Elks Club side of the premises, ostensibly to hide our ugly building from their sight. And these are, of course, those big, huge brassia trees that you see along the property as you come in. And the idea was to provide a virtual prison wall.
Yeah.
So that the Elks could not see our club.
Presumably you had your kitchen in.
Kitchen was in. The bar was complete, substantially. The kitchen was complete to the point that we could, they could make poo-poos and produce drinks for a cocktail party only at Christmas time. And fortunately, we were blessed with beautiful weather, and the membership attended in droves. We had a dozen parking boys to make it easy to come in and out. We required and needed every one of them. I believe that the reaction of the membership was very good. I think they were very pleased with what they saw, and we were very proud that we were able to meet our deadline that we had self-imposed.
Well, that was quite an undertaking, Klein, and you met your deadline, and everybody was in, and of course there were many finishing touches. When was the kitchen actually ready for meals?
Well, you might remember that we were on the premises of the old club to midnight of December 31st, 1963, at which time we had firecrackers and tears, mm-hmm. as everybody said goodbye to the, here again I like to say, the new old club or the old new club. January 1st, 2nd, and 3rd was a period at which no membership could be on either of the two premises, because those are the 3 days that were required for a transition from one site to the other. And I must say that Don Ross, our manager at that time, did a super job, so that on Saturday, January 4th, the club opened for the first time here at the new site.
Well, that's great. Now let's stop there, Klein. I'd like to depart from your building story, unless you have any other things to add at the moment, and go back a little ways. When we were talking about the clearing of the land, you mentioned the name Kapua being a sand dune. Is that an ancient name or a name of a part or just this particular area? How did that name evolve? I know that you have a reputation not only of being an historian of the club, but quite an historian as to the land of Hawaii, and in your capacity as an engineer and a surveyor, it might come naturally, but I'm sure you can fill us in about Kapua.
Well, I think we should start with what the land divisions were in Hawaii. We're talking about sections called ahupuas. And these are sections that were designated 500 to 600 years ago by ancient Hawaiians based on topographical features, ridges, watercourses, and the like. But an ahupua'a could be anything from the smallest that I am aware of is something like 2 or 3 acres in Lahaina to the largest in Kau on the island of Hawaii being Kahuku, something like 190,000 acres. So you have roughly 1,200 ahupua'as in all of Hawaii, ranging from 2 to 190,000 acres in size. These were designated, as I said, about 500 to 600 years ago, and they're named also at that period of time. Many of the ahupua'as have subdivisions called ilis. Now, on this island, we have about 80 ahupua'as, and one of them is the ahupua'a of Waikiki. And it comes as a great surprise to most people, newcomers, old-timers alike, to realize that the name Waikiki is not, in its ancient sense, what is commonly known as Waikiki today in the tourist Malahini sense. The common definition of Waikiki to the media and to the tourist bureau and others associated with it is an area bounded by the Alawai Canal and Kapahulu Avenue. Waikiki in its ancient sense is all the land extending from about, in general terms, where Ward Avenue is, all the way out to Hawaii Kai, including Kuli'o'o, but just stopping short of Bishop Estate's land at Mauna Loa. It extends from the sea to the top of the Ko'olau Range, roughly 22,000 acres. And in those 22,000 acres, about 80 or 90 ilis, I mentioned earlier, subdivisions. Now in Waikiki, one of the ilis is the name of Kikio. And Kikio is pretty much like most of the ilis in Waikiki, and matter of fact, most of the ilis in any ahupua'a. It's comprised of more than one piece. One of the pieces of the ili of Kikiu is what is known as a lele. It's a piece. It's a detached piece. The lele here is called kapua, and it's bounded by the sea on the Makai side and by the limestone cliffs on the Mauka side, roughly where the La Pietra is, La Pietra being in the ili of Kapahulu.
And we are in the...
We are in the ili of Kikio, and in this particular lele of it, or piece of it, which is called Kapua. Now, the boundary on the north side, it runs along the face of the Kaimana Beach Hotel. That is where the old Pacific Commercial Cable lot was. It's about, as I recall, about 20 feet wide. And when the cable company went out of existence, the next property owner to the south, which is the McInerney property, where people purchased that. And so it's all McInerney now, and it's under lease to
Kaimana.
To the Kaimana Hotel. Yeah. On the south side, the boundary is roughly where Coconut Avenue is. And this particular site that we're on is a large sand dune. And evidence of that is revived continually whenever you see contractors digging trenches. Inevitably out comes white sand. Now, the boundary between Kapua and the next land of Kaneloa, which is Crown Land, is an old watercourse. You don't see it now because it's long since been intercepted by Kapi'olani Park. But anybody knows that after a rain, what used to lead the runoff from Mauka to the sea is now commonly called Lake Kapi'olani.
Yeah.
Kids take the surfboards out and have a ball.
That's because the park has intercepted or overrun the natural water course.
That's correct. Now, that water course, thousands of years ago, of course, contributed or was the factor which opened up the reef and the lagoon, which is known as the Sanssouci Lagoon and the Sanssouci Channel, which on ancient maps is called the Kapua Entrance. Everybody knows whenever you have fresh water exiting, you have a channel that goes out through the
coral can't grow.
Coral cannot grow in fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's that very channel that we utilized in breaking through and in creating our lagoon, so that we utilized the old ancient channel out. Because those who swim and sail all the time can see every day the remains of two very good cables from the originally installed by the Pacific Commercial Cable. The cable station here was the terminal of the line that went, I believe, to Midway and west to the Orient. Now, another land of interest was the land of Kaluokau, which was one of the lands of William Charles Lunalilo. And that is the site of the old or original Abraga Canoe Club. As it turned out that in the Moheli, Kaluokau was one of William Lunalilo's lands, but a portion of it was bequeathed to his very close favorite, who was Emma. And Emma was one of the few people that he made bequests to.
Emma Rook, who is the Queen of Kamehameha IV.
That's right, uh-huh. Queen Emma, who was, of course, a widow at the time.
Yeah.
He described the land as his marine residence. Well, there was a challenge almost immediately by the trustees of the Lulu Trust as to what constituted the marine residence, because the Emma trustee wanted to interpret that description as being all of Kaluokau, which includes all of the land, Mauka of Kalakaua Avenue, where the marketplace is, and all of the Queen Emma lands, where all those hotels are, up Kuioa Avenue, etc. And it went to the Supreme Court for a decision. The net result is that the Queen Emma trustee took possession only of the land Makai of the Road and a certain portion Mauka, where his actual residence was, but not all of the Tara Patches and other cooler lands that supported.
Where was his, do you recall where his residence was in terms of present-day landmarks?
Pretty much where the marketplace is.
The marketplace there off Kuhio.
Right. Well, off Kalakaua.
Off Kalakaua,
yeah.
I see. Right there, between Kalakaua and Kuhio.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And more toward Kalakaua.
And that's bounded by Liliuokalani?
No. No, by... it's bounded by, well, what happened was, the Lunalilo trustees eventually sold the remaining of the land that the court had decreed was not Queen Emma's, sold it to the Queen Emma trustee.
I see.
So that's how they took possession eventually of all of that particular ili. But initially it was just the Queen's, the King's Waikiki, quote, Waikiki residence. But if you recall, those who founded the Abraga Canoe Club dealt with Bruce Cartwright, who is the then sole trustee of the Queen Emma estate. And it was through his efforts that we got the lease. Other trustees that I can think of were Platt Cook, who's now dead, but he was one of the engineers of that first informal lease for 5 years, and then the subsequent 25-year lease to terminate in 1938.
Klein, do you have any theories as to how the name of Waikiki evolved to the beach area alone, that is in popular use? Do you think it was part of Lunalilo's, or
no,
did it go beyond
that? No, there are two types of people speaking of Waikiki. You have those who are charged with lands, charged with knowing the names of lands, custodians of lands, who knew intimately what and where each ahupua'a was. They're in the very small minority. Mostly, you're dealing with the ordinary commoner, the layman, who latches on to a name, and first thing you know, it becomes the popular name, and then it becomes a restricted usage of it. Even the very first travelers spoke about going out to Waikiki, even then, going out as if they were going out to the bathing area, without regard to what the Maheli book says, that Waikiki is all the way up there. It's hard for people to realize that anybody up in Auka Manoa is in Waikiki. And yet, S.P. Kalama, one of the brilliant young Hawaiians that was, and I think, in the first class at Lahaina Luna, and was the clerk of the Moheli book, and a subsequent surveyor, and extremely knowledgeable in land names and boundaries, surveyed some kulianas up in Kahoʻiwai, which is an ili up in Upper Manoa, about as far as you can drive, and very accurately describes the kulianas as being in the ili of Kahoʻiwai, ahupua of Waikiki. It's difficult. But I have no quarrel with those who want to call it Waikiki, but you've got to remember that how senseless it is when you say that Waikiki is bounded by the Ulawai Canal, and the Ulawai Canal wasn't even built until the mid-20s.
That's right.
Kapahulu Avenue wasn't laid out until the 1880s. So you're talking about something that's yesterday in time, and Waikiki as an entity and as a land name goes back 600 years.
Klein, as you know, we're about to send out a call for books and other literature for our library. And, of course, our archives have been in existence now for about 2 years, and they're still forming as to indexing and so forth. Whether for the library or the archives, do you think that there might be a set of old maps, or copies certainly of old maps, that we could obtain, that the club could obtain, in which we could show the entire ahupua of Waikiki just out of interest, and then bring it down to the kapua and sort of trace it that way, maybe with a few little editorial comments from you? Do you think that kind of a project is possible?
I don't believe there is one in existence. I've prepared one myself for use in talks I've given. Essentially, it's a tax map, section map, on which I've delineated boundaries and colored up certain ilis in the interior, only a dozen or so out of the 80 or 90, for a specific purpose. And I've had slides made of it so that it can be cast upon a screen. But the only detailed maps of Waikiki are generally from, take in the area, generally from Ala Moana Shopping Center, maybe from Piikoi. No, maybe all the way from McCully. But don't go much further past Diamond Head.
That's the old map.
Yeah, that map by S.C. Bishop. And it doesn't take you all the way up to the crest of the Ko'olau either. It only takes you to, say, about where the University of Hawaii would be. University of Hawaii would be in Waikiki. Well, Manoa and Palolo is in Waikiki.
When our efforts to consolidate the archives and the library get a little further along, we'd like to come to you for some guidance to get some of those maps. Would you be willing to help us on that?
Certainly would.
Great. Is there anything else you want to add on Kapula?
Well, no. Before I close on me.
Well, Klein, just to wind this thing up, you know, I meant to ask you earlier, or even by way of introduction, you're a member of the very exclusive Winged O Club, aren't you? And that's one of the feathers in your bonnet. And, of course, you've been on the board. How long did you serve on the board?
I served 10 years totally. 5 years one time, a hiatus of 3 years, and then 5 years again. I'm very proud of the fact that of the 10 years I was a director, 7 years I was always also an officer, which required that not only I must attend directors' meetings, I must attend also the meetings of the executive committee.
That's a lot of meetings. Are you able to get to them all?
Yes, I did. I think I'm the only one who could say that I have a perfect attendance at the executive committee and members of the board of directors. Not only those particular meetings, but other meetings called in a special sense, and also the annual meetings that at the end of the year. I'm very proud of that fact.
Well, maybe we ought to send you to Congress. We'd get a better attendance at our meetings there than some of these birds are being showing in the latest census.
Well, you're looking at the most uninclined politician. I would like to say one more thing I'm proud of, and that is that I appear to be the only director who had a father preceding me on the board of directors. And not only that, Dad was the chairman of the building committee at the previous site, and I was really his counterpart at this site. Quite proud of that.
That's an historic observation and rather a tender thing to look back on. Well, Klein, how old are you now?
I'm 59.
59 years old with all that behind you, and you've got a lot of years ahead of you as one of the distinguished members of the club.
You introduced me as an old-time member. I don't consider myself an old-time member. There are many amongst my friends who have been members of this club long before I joined, particularly those who had started as junior members.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been corrected before on the word old-time. Sometimes people think in terms of the number of years that a person has as his age. Sometimes it's the number of years as to being membership. I think in your case, it's the number of hours that you spend serving the club. So in that case, you're an old-timer. Okay? Will you accept that?
Thank you.
This concludes our interview on June the 7th, 1982 with John Klein Mann.